I'm Karen Florin, and this is the Storyline Podcast. Today we're here with attorney Chris Matty of the law firm Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter, a former assistant United States attorney who is going to help us through the process of what a federal grand jury does. Chris, would you just take a minute or so and talk about some of the incredibly impactful cases that you've worked on, and then we'll get into the mechanics of the federal grand jury.
Sure. And thanks for having me on. Let's see. I currently am working at the law firm of Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter, where I represent a number of families who lost children and loved ones at Sandy Hook in a defamation case against Alex Jones, an Austin-based conspiracy theorist. And so that's been taking up most of my time recently. But I think what you're most interested in is the work that I did when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And there, I supervised the Financial Fraud and Public Corruption Unit and had the chance to work on some very meaningful cases, targeting public corruption, misconduct by public officials, campaign finance violations, and conduct that really strikes at the heart of our democracy. So I was fortunate to be able to work on those cases in which we tried to hold public officials who had abused their trust to account.
Great. And of course, one of those cases was the prosecution of former Governor Roland and others in a campaign finance case. So you are intimately familiar, really, with the process of a grand jury investigation. We want to know more about it because there is currently one going on that may have some connection to New London's State Pier. Massive project that sort of the future of the city is relying on. Can you talk about who convenes a grand jury, who's involved with a grand jury, and what a grand jury does?
Yeah, one of the reasons I was so happy that you asked me on to discuss this is because the federal grand jury is a very, very important creature of the United States Constitution that a lot of people don't know about. So the grand jury was part of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, in which the founders decided that no citizen could be charged with a felony offense unless they were charged by a grand jury. This was a way of avoiding someone being charged at the whim of the king. And instead of one person being able to accuse somebody of a crime, their peers had to be the ones to review evidence to decide whether a member of the community should be charged with a crime. And so now nobody can be charged with a felony under federal law unless a grand jury decides that there's probable cause to believe that they've committed that offense. And so grand juries are sitting throughout Connecticut, normally in Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven. And they are made up of between 16 and 23 people. They are called to jury service the same way anybody would be called as if they were going to sit on a trial jury. And they may not realize it when they get their summons in the mail, that what they're being called for is actually to serve on a grand jury. And so a grand jury sits for 18 months. Each grand jury will sit for about 3 days a month. And so it's not as if you need to quit your job to sit on a grand jury. And during that time period, the United States Attorney's Office will present evidence that they've obtained under the authority of the grand jury to the grand jury about potential criminal wrongdoing. And the reason that the grand jury sit for 18 months is because oftentimes investigations take a long time to develop evidence. And so you want one grand jury hearing all of the evidence in a case so that they can consider it as a full package when the time comes. And then only if 12 members of the grand jury decide that there's probable cause to believe that an individual has committed a crime, can somebody be charged? And at that point, the grand jury would return what's called an indictment. So that's a basic overview.
Now, are they probably working on several cases if they're sitting for 18 months?
And oh, yes.
Do they focus on the cases consecutively or sort of at the same time?
So, you know, they are dealing with multiple investigations throughout their term. sometimes a case may be very simple. So for example, you're in New London, you know, there may be a traffic stop in New London where the New London police arrests somebody who's in possession of a gun. And they're, let's say, had previously been convicted of a felony. So that's a federal offense, very straightforward case. A federal prosecutor might present that case in an hour to the grand jury. And a more complex investigation like the one you referenced involving former Governor John Rowland might take a year. And they will be hearing evidence each month that's developed each month, sometimes reviewing documents, sometimes hearing from witnesses who are subpoenaed to the grand jury to give their testimony. I should mention that the grand juries meet in secret. And so the grand jurors are forbidden from disclosing what they learn in the grand jury. They're not identified to the public as being grand jurors. And the reason for that is because oftentimes they're investigating conduct that may not result at all in a criminal charge. And so we want to make sure that just because somebody's activities are being investigated by the grand jury, you know, they are not tarnished by virtue of that investigation, unless, you know, eventually they're charged with an offense, at which time it would become public. So grand juries are very important and critical in both the investigation and enforcement of federal criminal laws.
Now, is it the prosecutor who convenes the grand jury?
So no, it's the federal courts convene the grand jury. And so if you were to receive your notice in the mail, it would come from the United States District Court. And then the grand jury is selected by the presiding judge with the assistance of the prosecutor, who's going to be responsible for the day-to-day operations of the grand jury. Once the grand jury is impaneled or selected, it day-to-day, it's really run by the United States Attorney's Office. And the United States Attorney's Office has guidelines that it has to follow to ensure that the rights of individuals who are under investigation are protected, to ensure that the grand jury is not abused. So for example, the U.S. attorney doesn't issue subpoenas, the grand jury issues subpoenas. And so when a grand jury issues subpoenas for documents, those documents need to be presented to the grand jury. The U.S. attorney has responsibility for kind of managing the day-to-day investigative activities of the grand jury, but under the supervision of the district court.
It's such incredible power that you're describing that this body has. They have to have at least a basic understanding of how the law works. As a federal prosecutor, did you spend a lot of your time educating before you actually got down to the work?
Yeah, so some prosecutors will describe the basic law that the grand jury is going to be considering before they present the evidence. Some will do it at the conclusion of their presentation of evidence. When a grand jury is initially sworn in, they are instructed about their obligations as a grand jury. So separate and apart from any laws that they may be trying to figure out whether they were broken or not, they're required to take an oath. They're instructed, for example, about the standard of evidence that they're going to be considering. So with a grand jury, remember, they're not deciding whether somebody's guilty of a crime. All they're deciding is whether there's sufficient evidence to accuse somebody of a crime. And so that standard is the probable cause standard. Is there probable cause to believe they've committed this crime? And each crime is made up of certain elements. Sometimes just a couple, sometimes more than that. And the grand jury needs to conclude that there's been sufficient evidence to establish that each of those elements has been met, probable cause to believe each of those elements have been met. They're instructed on what those elements are. And if they find, after receiving the legal instructions from the prosecutor, that they've received that type of evidence, then they can return an indictment.
So one of the things, of course, that frustrates us as the media is that we often can't get any information about the work of a grand jury as it's in process because of the secrecy. Is there something different about a public corruption trial that enables at least the release of a little bit of information?
Well, there's nothing about the fact that a public corruption matter might be under investigation that permits the government or the grand jury to release information about it. But because the grand jury is often issuing subpoenas to public entities, for example, like this, let's just say, you know, the city of New London may get a subpoena to provide the government with public records. Once the city of New London receives that subpoena, they're not bound by any secrecy obligations. They are a witness, and their First Amendment rights, for example, to express what they've been asked for by the grand jury remain in place. And that's why, you know, a public corruption investigations sometimes are disclosed publicly before they are concluded, because the documents that are being sought by the grand jury are being sought from public entities that, for example, in response to a Freedom of Information request, might release the subpoena they've received. Simply because of the nature of the investigation, neither the government nor anybody else has any different obligations as to the confidentiality.
You had a lot of tools as a U.S. attorney, including several investigative agencies. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the U.S. Attorney's Office works with federal law enforcement agencies, like, for example, the FBI or the DEA or the ATF or the Department of Homeland Security. And those agencies are really responsible for investigating and collecting evidence. They have their own authority to do that separate from the grand jury, like, for example, calling up a witness on the phone and seeing if they're willing to provide information about something, you know. And so the U.S. Attorney's Office works in partnership with those agencies to investigate potentially unlawful conduct. And the grand jury is a tool that they use, but not the only tool. And these agencies have quite a bit of expertise in the, you know, areas that they're responsible for investigating. So the FBI is primarily responsible for investigating public corruption. There are some other agencies that do as well, but the FBI is primarily responsible, and they have a lot of expertise and resources to do that. It's a team effort whenever you're conducting an investigation.
And I'm curious again about how, I think I may have asked this a little bit clumsily before, how is a grand jury investigation born? Does the FBI notify the U.S. attorney, hey, I have this case, I think we ought to, you know, go for a grand jury investigation on this?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So the FBI, in order to open a matter, let's say, before you even get to the grand jury, okay, the FBI needs to have established a certain predicate of evidence. So think of it as like a reasonable suspicion. That's a legal term, but the FBI needs to have developed some information totally separate from the grand jury that there may be some illegal conduct occurring. Once they've done that, they'll often contact the U.S. Attorney's Office, say, we have this matter open. We think that we've developed predication. That's the term. You know, you have to have a predicate for believing that you should advance to what is considered a more intrusive stage of the investigation, where they might say, hey, you know, we think that we're ready for a grand jury. And what that oftentimes means is we want to subpoena somebody's telephone records, not the contents of their calls, but seeing who they're calling. Or we may want to subpoena somebody's bank records to see where this money that we have reason to believe was obtained illegally went. And at that point, the U.S. attorney will make a decision to say, yep, I agree. You developed sufficient evidence to involve a grand jury. I'm not making any decisions about whether any crimes were committed or by whom, but we need to investigate this further. They'll open up a grand jury matter case. And then that grand jury will be responsible for hearing evidence and collecting evidence along with the U.S. attorney for the duration of the investigation. And the grand jury, I should say, during that, the presentation of evidence has the opportunity to ask witnesses questions if they want, ask the agent questions. Sometimes grand juries will say, hey, you know, you subpoenaed certain documents, but not others. We think these other documents would be very helpful for us. In which case the U.S. attorney may then issue a subpoena in the grand jury's name for those documents. So, you know, I found that in long-term investigations, the having the collaboration and the assistance of the grand jury could be very useful.
That's great. And by the way, is there no judge in the room for the most part?
There's no judge in the room. Nope. The only time that a judge is involved in the grand jury proceedings is at the very beginning when they select the grand jury. When a grand jury returns an indictment, that indictment is presented to a United States magistrate judge who confirms that a sufficient number of jurors have voted to return the indictment. And then oftentimes at the end, when they thank the grand jury for their service. Now, there sometimes arise disputes between individuals who are the targets of an investigation and the United States Attorney's Office. For example, let's say the grand jury subpoenas records of somebody who is a subject or a target of the investigation. And that person's represented by a lawyer. And that lawyer says, no, this subpoena is seeking information that is protected or is far beyond what should be sought, and I'm going to challenge it. And they then will, you know, challenge it before a judge, and that proceeding is also secret, and a judge will then weigh in on, for example, whether somebody has, you know, some sort of privilege or protection from complying with a subpoena. But the day-to-day operations rarely involve the judges themselves.
Does the target of the investigation, whether it be a person or an entity, have access to the grand jury proceedings?
Not as a matter of right. So it's important to remember that the grand jury is not an adversarial setting. So it's not like when somebody's been charged and there's a trial and the defendant can present evidence and the prosecutor presents evidence. It's not like that. Because of the prosecutor's special obligations of candor to the grand jury and fairness, it is, as a matter of policy, the U.S. Attorney's Office does present what's considered exculpatory evidence to the grand jury. And so oftentimes a sophisticated lawyer or defense lawyer will say, hey, listen, I understand that you're investigating my client. I expect you to present all the evidence, including evidence suggesting that my client did not do what you're investigating. And, you know, I might point you to other sources of information. Oftentimes, if an individual wants to testify before the grand jury, they will be a target. They will be permitted to do that. That doesn't happen very often because it's often not in the target's best interest to give sworn testimony to the grand jury. But if a request is made, often it will be honored.
Can you estimate how frequently a grand jury investigation leads to an indictment?
You know, I don't think I can. If an indictment is presented to a grand jury, it's most common for the grand jury to return the indictment or approve the indictment. Because by that time, you know, the prosecutor and the grand jury have collected enough evidence to know whether or not, you know, an indictment is appropriate or not. So it's easier for me to say that in the overwhelming majority of cases in which a federal prosecutor proposes an indictment, the grand jury agrees with that. But it's much harder for me to say in all the investigations, you know, what percentage of them wind up in indictments. Quite a few do not. And that's for a whole host of reasons, including that sometimes investigations reveal that there's just not sufficient evidence of criminal wrongdoing to support an indictment, or it may support an indictment for some individuals who are involved, but not everybody who was initially under investigation.
Is there anything else that our listeners should know about a grand jury. And then after that, Chris, would you mind talking a little bit about whether you've been following this investigation regarding Costa Diamantis and any thoughts you might have on that?
Well, I hope that your listeners have enjoyed the conversation. They may never want to directly hear about the grand jury because that oftentimes is not a good sign unless they're being, selected for grand jury service. I would just say that I think it's a remarkable innovation of our Constitution to have members of the community both collect evidence and hear evidence to decide whether others have committed crimes against the community. Because remember, when somebody's accused of a crime, they're accused of violating the law of the United States. It's a crime against the United States. And I think it's appropriate that, just average citizens are the ones to consider that, it being such a serious thing in somebody's life if they're accused of a crime. So it's a protection that, hopefully, most of us will never need, but it's an important one. So I would say that I have not been following closely the investigation involving the New London port, other than just the recent, disclosure of the existence of a subpoena that was directed to the state of Connecticut. And so I really don't know much about it at all. And I think anybody who does suggest they know a lot about it is probably not being totally straight with you. But I'm sure that the U.S. Attorney's Office will investigate it fully and comprehensively, however they feel it should proceed. But I probably can't comment much beyond that.
Okay. And by the way, since we did just hear about the issuance of that subpoena, which was back in October, is there any way of knowing what stage they might be at with this investigation right now?
It's whenever you see a subpoena that requests a broad set of documents, which is how I would characterize that subpoena, it normally suggests that that the investigation is at a relatively early stage. I probably couldn't say much more than that. Some investigations move quickly, some don't. But at least, I think you can probably safely assume that when the subpoena was issued, it was at a relatively early stage of the investigation.
Now, are you able to get, are the attorneys able to get a good cross-section of the community to participate in grand jury investigations, since it is such a, time-consuming effort?
You really want to. To have a cross section, of course, not everybody can take 3 days off a month, and you do get paid some stipend, but for most people, it's not going to make up what you would lose. And you hope also that employers, especially large employers, agree to pay their employees their full salary on the days that they have off for grand jury. Folks who are retired tend to be overrepresented in among those who can serve, but that doesn't mean that they end up being overrepresented on the grand jury. Really what you're looking for is just a group of people who can credibly say that they don't have any bias toward anybody for any impermissible reason. They're not biased in favor of law enforcement or against law enforcement. They don't harbor any sort of racial or religious bias. They have an open mind. They want to hear all the facts before they make a decision. They're able to, discuss their views with others in a productive way. That's really what you want. In my experience, we were able to get that. And I also say, in my experience, grand jurors found their experience sitting on the grand jury to be really amazing and life-changing in terms of their perspective on our justice system. So I hope that if people get the grand jury summons, after they initially think, oh crap, I don't know if I can get time off, they realize it's a tremendous opportunity to serve your community.
Excellent. Well, it's been amazing to actually sort of go inside a grand jury by speaking with you, Chris. Have you been following the situation with our chief state's attorney, Mr. Colangelo, and his potential involvement in this case? And would you care to comment on that?
I have been following that. I think that what you're referring to is the report that the former United States Attorney Stan Torti prepared for the governor about Mr. Colangelo's hiring of the daughter of somebody who was a top state budget office at the same time that Mr. Colangelo was trying to lobby that person to approve raises for himself and his staff. I have been following it. I think it's deeply disappointing and saddening development to see a prosecutor behaving in the way Mr. Torti concluded he had behaved, which was, according to Mr. Torti, not only appearing to be offering somebody who lacked qualifications for a job outside the normal hiring process, but doing it at the same time that he was trying to convince her father to take official action. It's very troubling, but I think what was even more troubling than that was Mr. Torti's conclusion that when he interviewed Mr. Colangelo, Mr. Colangelo was not credible in his responses. And, you know, if a prosecutor has one thing that they need to protect at all times, it's their own credibility with everybody they deal with, the public, judges, defense lawyers, defendants. If you're not able to meet that standard, then you really do a disservice to everybody. It's very disappointing to see that.
And so I think some of us learned last week that the governor has nothing to do with the appointment of a chief state's attorney, and that this will be up to another body. Could you talk a little bit about that? Now, of course, we're switching over to from federal court, right, to the state system of criminal justice.
Right. So the Criminal Justice Commission is established to oversee state prosecutors, the hiring of state prosecutors, any discipline of state prosecutors. The governor has appoints a number of people to that commission, but others also have appointments to that commission. And the idea there is that it's a way of insulating prosecutors from politics. You know, so in Connecticut, you don't run for office as a prosecutor, thank goodness. You're supposed to be apolitical. And so that body, the Criminal Justice Commission, will decide whether or not Mr. Colangelo engaged in misconduct and should be disciplined or removed as chief state's attorney. My hope is that Mr. Colangelo would realize that he's kind of compromised his ability to do his job effectively before that happens. But if indeed he decides to contest those findings, the Criminal Justice Commission would decide what should happen.
Is there any precedent for that? Have we ever had, that you know of in your memory or knowledge, a chief state's attorney who was, in fact, removed from office by that commission?
I'm not aware of that ever having happened before. It's possible, but I don't believe so.
All right. We very much appreciate your time.
Oh, I appreciate your interest. Thank you, Karen.